for our audience at home, can you describe what is on your shirt?
It's serotonin and the dopamines. And the drum and the guitar are chemical symbol structures of the neurotransmitters that they looks like a drum kit and a guitar. And it's funny little neurons playing the parts.
Welcome, everybody, to the last episode of In Plain English Season 2. I'm your host, Jamie Moffa, and today we are going to be talking about the article BSOID, an open source unsupervised algorithm for identification and fast prediction of behaviors by Alexander Su and Eric Itri. So joining us today to talk about this is the last author himself, Dr. Eric Itri. So welcome to the podcast. Would you like to introduce yourself?
It's great to be here. My name's Eric. I was recently promoted to associate professor at Carnegie Mellon University. And our lab there is really interested in the big question of how do we translate thought into action. This paper was a really fun and hopefully useful method for many people, but we developed it in order to open some new questions, lines of questions in our lab.
Yeah. Well, first of all, congrats on the promotion. And I'm really excited to be talking about like a tools and methods paper, because I think that's kind of not something we've covered before on the podcast. So excited. And then our guest for this episode is Sarah Brown. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm Sarah. I am a freelance podcast producer and editor here in Brooklyn.
Well, thank you for being on.
Yeah, thank you. I'm excited. I'm excited to talk about science things and charts and data. Let's do it.
All right. So without further ado, Eric, would you like to talk a little bit about this paper?
Sure. So the paper tries to get at the question of what is behavior? In neuroscience, particularly behavior or motor neuroscience, a lot of the times the field tends to use tasks. This applies to humans, but particularly to animal models. The individual may perform, say, pressing a lever or reaching to a target hundreds, thousands, even hundreds of thousands of times. And this is in many ways a benefit. It provides what we think of as one discrete behavior to study, that reaching or that pressing, with a nice start and a stop time. And you can go on from there and analyze it. The problem, though, is that these behaviors are typically rather arbitrary from an evolutionary standpoint. They're not ethologically relevant. And also most of us, again, humans, mice, whatever the case might be, aren't doing the same thing over and over and over again for tens of thousands of trials. Also, it's hard to get at questions of decision-making or things like this, action selection, if your only choices are reach to the left or reach to the right. It's a fairly reduced dimensionality of that behavior space, which may or may not be any of these, may or may not be reflected in the neural activity that's responsible for all these movement choices and movement performances. The flip side, though, up until recently wasn't great. Although you and I might know walking, turning, rearing, grooming, if you just think about your pet and all the behaviors there, there's some canonical categories of behavior, but they're kind of subjective, particularly subjective in when they start and when they stop. If we want to say exactly when something started, particularly at anything that's meaningful at a neuronal time scale, which is typically on the order of milliseconds, that gets tough. It's also subjective. You and I might have different opinions as to what constitutes walking or turning, etc. We were interested in trying to open the door to these what are called naturalistic behaviors to study in mice what their behavior is as they just go about their day. And we realized that in the past several years, there's been a huge interest in a data analysis method, computer vision process called pose tracking. A lot of people will be familiar with deep lab cut. There's also several other ones. Sleep is an excellent product. But the idea is that using computer vision, you can tell where a hand or a foot or a nose is. And this is great, except the interpretability is kind of low. That's still, just because I know where a hand is, it doesn't mean I know if that hand is grooming or walking. So it's really the spatial temporal patterns of the distance and the speed and the angle between all these points. And so we realized, and Alex is an absolutely fantastic computational mind and coder and all around tour de force powerhouse. We realized, well, this is just patterns. So can we take these positions and develop creative ways to extract the patterns from those positions? That provides an unsupervised way, so it takes out the human bias, to very, very high throughput, get what these individual behaviors are that a mouse is doing, or a monkey or a human. And actually, because it is just a pattern recognition machine, which is we're using for behavior, it's applicable to anything. We've had people from genomics reach out. Actually, the day that the paper was published, a seismologist in California reached out and said, I've been looking for motifs in the seismic waves for decades. Thanks for making my job really easy. It beats anything that I've come up with. So we're happy that they have that. We're using it mainly for capturing behavior accurately and at these fine timescales.
That's really cool. I would never have thought to apply it to seismology and earthquakes.
Yeah, kudos to him for reading a neuroscience paper and saying, oh, wait, I can steal this.
I think like a question that I had is if you can dive into a little bit more what unsupervised means versus like supervised. So does that mean you just kind of like you don't do anything to the like images or videos you're giving to it? And you're just like, here, make something of this.
Largely, yes. And so one important thing to point out, because I often get this question, is people will ask, oh, well, how is this better than Deep Lab Cut or any of these other pose estimation softwares? The quick response is it doesn't. We're not taking in video like those do. We're taking the output of those algorithms. And so that'll give us a position, an X and a Y, and if you have multiple cameras, a Z as well. So a position in space for that point, and then we just make it interpretable. So rather than just a position, we say the pattern of these positions is consistent with walking, rearing, grooming, and finer details thereof. Just wanted to get that out of the way. In terms of the difference between unsupervised and supervised, you more or less have that definition spot on. The effort is much, much less for an unsupervised algorithm like B-Side. You put in data and then the algorithm goes through and says, here's the patterns that I think exist. And there's one, other than loading up the data, there's a really nice user interface and GUI to go through this. If you want specific needs, you can go into the command line as well. But the only thing that the user needs to do is to move a slider that says, I want the algorithm to find only the most obvious patterns, or I want the algorithm to find anything that looks like a pattern and then everything in between. And so that just gives the platform a sense of what you're looking for. But after that, it's entirely hands off, which is great because it's no more work for you. And it also means that you or somebody else doesn't get to imprint their subjectivity to it. The trade-off, though, is that with supervised learning, unlike unsupervised, is you get what you want. And so for complicated or nuanced behaviors, which particularly are important in fields like social behaviors, B-Side won't do well. If you put in two animals into the arena and monitor the position of all their body parts, what you'll get is category one of mouse one was walking and mouse two was grooming. And then the next action will be mouse one was rearing and mouse two was also rearing, or all those combinations thereof. You won't get the social interactions in part, or at least not easily, in part because they are more rare, and that if you just look at within animal, is this thing walking or grooming, that's going to happen much more often and much more in a consistent way. As a small plug, we did have B-Side. It's out. We are hopefully in the last rounds of revision for A-Side, and it's on BioArchive, and the code's all out, and plenty of people seem to love it. And so that provides the supervised approach, and still gets you through some tricks that we learned with B-Side, gets you through to better performance than really anything that's out there right now at 1/6 the time. Plug for A-Side, spelled the same. I guess I should say A-Soid. I was figuring someone from Brooklyn might actually pronounce the two the same way. And the nice thing with A-Side is once you get the supervised, you can then go through and get behavioral discovery with B-Sides built into it. So you can start with the unsupervised or the supervised to get whatever level of detail you as an experimenter want.
So are you going to have images for A-Side and B-Side that are like a record?
That's actually, if you go onto our GitHub, I think it's true for B-Side. I know it's true for A-Side. It is a cool looking record with an A and a mouse and a monkey on it, which sounds like a garbled mess when you say it out loud, but it itself is a little square icon and is pretty cool. But yeah, it has a sort of stylized like the Astros with a record behind it, because B-Side itself, we were riffing off of Deep Cut, which is the original pose estimation that Deep Lab Cut is based upon. And Deep Cut is an audio thing. So we went with B-Side. Got to keep going with the dad jokes.
That's great. I love dad jokes. So why did you decide to use mice in this particular thing? Is that just the go-to specific task subject for these types of things?
So the algorithm will work on any organism or even not an organism. We in the lab were already using mice. I've hopped around between a few model organisms in my life. We're using mice. The other benefit that I'd say is if you're a quadruped, you walk around on four legs, your behaviors are typically easily captured either through a camera from above, or especially with a clear floor and a camera from below. Almost all the time, you can see everything that matters, the position of each limb. Once you get into animals that are somewhat bipedal, for instance, monkeys, which technically are quadrupeds, but are performing actions in more 3D, and certainly humans, now that bottom up becomes, or top down becomes less useful. Still possible from the bottom up, or you go through a somewhat complicated practice of using multiple cameras. And there's several fantastic groups out there now that, for instance, with non-human primates, are using something like 66 cameras arranged all throughout an arena to make sure everything's getting captured. When we get 3D position from mice, we just use four. We can still see everything that we need to. So 66 might be a little much, but it's quite good and quite thorough. The real reason was just because that's what we're primarily interested in asking questions about. But there are some technical things that, I mean, even we're working with a Parkinson's disease group working out with human patients. And so everything works out great as long as the patient stays facing the camera. If they turn to the side, now everything's off. And certainly if they turn around, well, you can't see their hands.
Interesting. That's so cool. Yeah. Wow. Because I would think like a lot of people would use like rats for this type of thing because they're so intelligent and they can like, especially with like decision making and stuff, they're used in a lot of that.
Certainly so. Mice are probably smarter than people give them credit for, but rats are certainly more intelligent. And some of that gets back to looking at an organism in a context that's more closely related to what evolution has designed them to do. Famous example of this, a wonderful neuroscientist at Caltech, Marcus Meister, has taken, pretty sure it's mice, put them in a maze that has something like 32 different left-right decisions. I would fail right out at trying to do this. And with a couple of trials that they know exactly how to go from the start to the reward, it's almost freakish how good it is. Yeah, I think an argument could be made that the more mental faculty you have, you can probably take on more complicated things that may or may not fit in with the types of problems that you'd normally encounter. There's even flies, which you can use B-side on the fly. It's in the paper. They can compute and solve some problems that I can't do, in part because I'm not a fly.
I mean, I think this is like part of what you were saying in the very beginning of introducing this, is that a lot of times research involves like, let's make a mouse press a lever. And then we're like, why, having done some behavioral research, is like, why isn't this mouse pressing this lever? This mouse is so dumb that it can't figure out how to press a lever to get a food reward. But it's like, the mouse doesn't really need to press a lever as part of its like daily existence. And it's not really a normal thing for a mouse to do. So asking it to press a lever is getting it to like do something that's totally not like useful in any other mouse context. Whereas like, I think maybe one of the things that you might be hoping this is useful for is like being able to interpret more like mouse relevant behavior in terms of decision making, as opposed to pressing a lever.
And there still is value in those as long as you take the caveats, because I'll admit I did my postdoc and still am having mice play with a PlayStation 3 controller. We put a coat hanger in the end and it moves around a cursor. And so there are some questions that's fantastic for, and that, you know, if you want to study learning, it's hot. You know, by the time we're monitoring these mice, they already know all of their natural behavior repertoire. So there's no real learning that we can do. And, you know, decision making we can introduce, and we're doing some studies right now at trying to invoke specific contexts for decision making. But in terms of kinematic control of a reach, where we manipulate some reaches and not others, that's a whole lot easier to answer that specific type of question. It really all comes down to using the right tool to answer the right question, which we think B-side opens up a whole lot of possibilities that, not better or worse, but might get us reveal more about what the innate brain is actually doing and what those computations are right out of the box.
Well, yeah. As someone with ADHD, I just found it like all really interesting, because we always have a lot of trouble like making decisions and like stuff like that. So I found it all like, oh, wow, like this is what we do, or how we like study it.
We actually just we're almost through quarantine of the flip side. We have a OCD model of or a mouse model of OCD that, now that we have a great baseline for what a normal mouse is, and it's a whole different topic as to what a normal lab mouse is. But compared to that, we can look at OCD models, Parkinson's models. There's a fantastic group in Vancouver that's looking at Huntington's disease. Some other people looking at how pain affects. We just had collaborated with several groups on a neuron paper that came out a month or two ago, looking at how pain changes behavioral decision making, as well as the performance and response to certain stimuli. So this sort of approach to getting at really what is behavior needn't be watch an animal go about its day. It can be with more direction to it. And certainly, once you have the baseline, you can start asking these questions. You know, for OCD, it's just, does the mouse groom a whole lot more than normal? And that's, again, a rather coarse measure. And we might be missing all sorts of things. Last figure of the paper it looks at grooming, that with conventional models of just saying, how often is the animal grooming? You wouldn't have noticed anything due to the manipulation, but there's huge differences and specific to one type of grooming that we only were able to pick out because of B-side identifying that and having the pose estimation to give us the kinematics. To riff on that ADHD. I don't know that there's a mouse model of ADHD, but...
Awesome. Mice are just so much more interesting than we give them credit for. And as someone who like sees rats and mice like every day, I never think like, oh, they could help us like learn more about human characteristics and how we decision make and things like that. But
that's ideally the case. And you know, if we can answer, get to that same thing in sea elegans or flies, I'll take it too.
I'd love to see that. I don't know. I don't know. I feel like flies are a little more unpredictable.
Different behavioral repertoires, but in the right context, there's been a, I think for behavior overall, not just for this, or not even for rodents, there's been a really big explosion in the last, not even decade, of saying, all right, let's see what animals can do. And you know, the benefit with that several people are using with flies, they're all the fly lines, but you can run 5,000 animals through an assay because you have 5,000 of them. And that's, as long as you figure out the right way to do it. At Janili, I know there's a fun, they can look at flies turning left or right, given the visual field in front of them and change things like that. The experiment I like the most is there was a platform with concentric rings around it and a moat in between. And so in terms of motor dexterity, the space between each platform got bigger and bigger and bigger. So you just put a bunch of flies on that middle platform and see how many can get how far out. I think that's brilliant. And you know, you've got all of your mutants that you might want. So it's a great time to be studying behavior, and most of it, all of it, has plenty of things to tell us about how the brain works.
This is so interesting right now. What are the graphs about like the head grooming and stuff? And like you're correlating like the distance. Can you explain that? I think this is figure 6.
So that's the example I just mentioned, that B-side identified the three canonical types of grooming, which are of the snout and so right at the front. And if you think of a cat or hamster, they do the same thing of right at the snout. And then the bigger sort of head groom that often involves pulling the ear down, which is a much bigger movement. And there's also body grooming, but that's not in that figure. And even though for decades, it's just been accepted and well accepted that these are different types of behaviors, at least 90%, if not much more than that, of papers that study grooming really just put it all into one category, particularly the face and the head, because it's too much of a pain in the butt to try and break them apart, because it's typically people going through frame by frame or with a stopwatch and counting time. And so that figure really sort of shows what the benefit is. One, you don't have to go through with a stopwatch anymore. You can go through 100,000 frames in a few dozen minutes, and depending on your computer, much more than that. But also because it readily identifies the difference between these two behaviors, you have them. And then that paper showed that these were animals that we got that had a lesion to the indirect pathway of the basal ganglia. So some animals that a collaborator had, we were able to identify that there were deficits, but only in one of the two of those types of grooming of the head area. And specifically that there was a change in the speed and the distance of each one of those strokes of the face that, again, if you just had a stopwatch, you wouldn't even pick that up. But these were huge, huge differences in terms of the performance. That's sort of the point of that last figure, to just show boots on the ground utility, not just that it works and that it can give you some cool data, but there might be several studies in these fields that care about grooming and said, oh, no, there's no difference. given a coarse measure? No huge difference, but who knows?
And a lot of those fine differences can, like, when you translate it into human terms about, like, you know, you're thinking about, well, you're translating this basal ganglia lesion is kind of maybe approximating something like Parkinson's, but you're translating it into human terms and you're like, those even mild differences in ability to perform like everyday tasks can be a huge deal. And if your ability to pick up something like that in an animal model isn't as like good and robust as it can be, you're not really going to be able to study, like, how can we make improvements in these small day-to-day tasks that people have to perform?
Absolutely. And, you know, if you look at common measures that we have for diseases, pressing a lever enough times or turning or distance covered, say for Parkinson's disease or grooming of the face, clinicians know that, and I think average lay people know, these diseases are far more complex than you might groom a little bit more or scratch your face a little bit more. And so this can open more of those doors and provide a richness of quantification that, yeah, it may be able to really help, if not assess, really build bridges between what we have in animal models, which are not humans, but make those bridges stronger for translating between the two of them.
And that's really important too, because right now there's a huge like issue within translating animal model research into human models, where you like test something in an animal model and you're like, it works great, we're gonna like make a drug out of it, we're gonna start trials and start giving it to people, and then it doesn't work in people and you're like, what happened?
Testing something on a like a drug on a mouse, like a cancer drug or something, as opposed to like a human, don't we like digest it differently than they do?
Oh yeah, there can be several dozen reasons for why it doesn't translate. And the NIH actually, in recognizing this, I forgot the specifics, or not NIH, FDA, changed the rules about animal models and what research has to be done beforehand, which benefits, hopefully benefits both humans as well as the research animals. If you go through all of that and it's not worth it, it's not worth it to anyone.
Oh, absolutely.
Particularly for neuropsychiatric models, there's been a whole lot of pushback, particularly from the NIH, that as we opened up discussing, mice aren't as smart as rats and certainly aren't as smart or diverse in their cognition as humans are. So there's a lot of, what does a schizophrenic non-human even do, or autism or any of these issues? And it's, it is, at least as far as we know, a fairly unique phenomenon to humans. There may be evidence one way or the other in related animals, but yeah, it makes, as well as all the other things facing any drug, that makes it far more difficult. I don't think, besides certainly isn't and approaches like it isn't a silver bullet, but maybe gets us at least a little bit better at quantifying things, but it still won't provide a meaningful model for neuropsychiatric disease. Mice don't have autism.
And like, what's the goal for this? Like, what are you after ACIDE is published and all of that? What's like your hope for their research?
Yeah, our goal is really to understand how multiple areas of the brain work together to create behavior. And part of that is learning based upon past experience or planning for the future. We've already begun pivoting and are working on a few papers now in which we take B-side or A-side for our newer data and record 3D position from a mouse while also using a somewhat new type of electrode called a neuropixel that allows us to record from all layers of motor cortex, dorsal striatum, which is another motor decision-y area that it projects to, and then ventral striatum, which is less than motor and movement, is more value and reward. So we're recording from over 350 neurons simultaneously and recording at 30,000 times a second the voltages from all of those, all of the behavior, pretty much 24/7 for a few weeks. Yeah, so we're recording from hundreds of neurons across a half dozen brain areas while we're getting every behavior an animal performs 24/7 for about 2 weeks. So that's 3 terabytes of data a day. It took us 6 months. I should say it mainly took Alex 6 months to figure out the data handling part of that, just to deal with 3 terabytes a day, because the problem isn't just the 3 terabytes. It's that if you don't deal with yesterday's data, you now have 6, and tomorrow you will have 9.
Well, I'm interested to see how, like, people will use this research to maybe study like criminal behavior or something like that. When people do things that, like, quote unquote, are like criminal or wrong, like seeing how, like, in their brain, like why they do those things and stuff like that. I'm interested to see if people like make that correlation.
That might be tough, in part because all that we can provide, at least applied how we're doing it, is, you know, breaking down different types of movements and, you know, stabbing. We can identify that, but there's much easier ways to identify stabbing. We have been a little bit concerned that it might be used for things closer to profiling. That being said, it's not that fancy, although there are several corporations who are now using this. But yeah, that thought has cropped into my mind a little bit. But I think at least for now, and certainly for what we are chiefly focused on, it's really for likely the next decade. Now, we've got hundreds of neurons, millions of actions over time. We're going to make it all openly accessible because there's far more than our group has time or expertise to get at in these data sets. And certainly, when we are about to add disease models to this to make comparisons and things, but just maybe to get a little bit closer to that criminal thing, we know that so many disorders aren't because one brain area or one cell type goes bad. And even if that is the case, the brain is not an island. It will have a plethora of downstream effects that themselves will have a myriad of other effects. And so maybe one of the things that has been standing in our way is this one area, one behavior approach that so much of neuroscience has taken on. If we can identify dynamics writ large across behaviors, across neurons and even brain areas, this might give us a bit more insight. I don't know that's going to stop any murders, but I hadn't really thought about that one. But it is a very different way at looking at things, not just the behavior. Many people are starting to look at these sorts of big questions, big more in terms of the data, but also it's going to take a lot to just make sense of. So I'd encourage anyone listening to this, if they want a whole bunch of LFP or spike times across a whole lot of brain areas and a whole lot of behaviors, let's answer some questions.
That is so cool from an open science standpoint, that it's like, hi, we have all this data. Let's collaborate, because like working alone, we can't really, you know, do that much with this because it's an insane volume, but working together, you might be really interested in this like particular behavior. And so like, let's work together to pull out that behavior and that like neuron data that goes with that behavior and see what goes on, what's happening. That is insanely awesome. I love open science and big data, things like that. And I feel like it's less common in basic science and animal research world. Because like there's a lot of human open data stuff that you like databases that you can look into from like huge fMRI databases. But I feel like it's less common. I like, at least from my own experience, most people tend to have their islands and they're like, I have all my data and I'm going to analyze all my data and I'm going to make a paper out of it. And then I'm going to go on to the next paper. And I think this is a very cool like paradigm shift.
What did you say? FMRI?
A like type of brain imaging. So a MRI is a magnetic resonance image and it uses like big old magnets to like look at the structure of your brain. So it can get you really high resolution images of the structure of your brain. You can use it to diagnose like brain tumors and stuff. The F is for functional. So what it adds on top of a regular MRI is that now you can see, I am not an expert in this, but basically you can see like use the magnetic field to know something about the like oxygen levels in the blood. And so like a brain area that's used, that's like more active is using more oxygen. And so you should see like a decrease in oxygen level. And so you should see like brain areas basically light up when you pass them through a whole bunch of analysis. And so what you can do is you can have people in a MRI machine and then have them do some kind of like task. It could be as simple as like adding numbers together or more complex, like remembering people's faces or something. And you can see what brain areas across like their whole brain are being more or less active when they're doing different kinds of things.
Oh, wow.
Or even just sitting in there doing nothing. So actually, since this is WashU based, there's a whole field of this work that revolves around what's called the default mode network that was discovered by Mark Raichel and Mike Fox, middle 2000s. And they just have somebody sit in there. And you see that you know, it's this sort of window into your thought of paying attention or not. Yeah, it's a really powerful tool. And I think one of the things that does allow the human imaging field to be a little bit more collaborative is they're all using largely the same tools and asking largely the same questions. It's also not a particularly large field, say compared to rodent neuroscience. So it's a little bit easier to get everyone on the same page. But maybe with the utility of this, and certainly between the post estimation algorithms that B-Side then makes use of, and the several algorithms like B-Side, there's a lot of push for open science and sharing of that. We just wrote a perspective piece that came out in eLife this spring that was across, I don't know, 10 different labs that are involved in various ways in this process of just, here's some best practices. Kevin Luxem is the first author on that, I think. It's because it is a newer thing and it's a smaller community, I think. I have hopes that we'll share in some of those same benefits. It's also just hard to do. There's plenty of people who study human imaging work who have never run an experiment on a fMRI because it's costly and difficult to do. And I got to say, if anyone wants to use B-Side and get neural data, more power to you. But it is, if you want to save time and you're interested in these same sorts of questions, save yourself the months of debugging, just data handling and getting the electrode right and everything else. I'm happy to help because I would have loved to have skipped that. So with rodents, there's so many individual questions and the experiments are comparatively easier to ask. So that's leads to more islands, like you said.
So here's a question, and I'm hoping I'm going to explain my thought process behind this question because I am a neuroscientist, and so I have the background, but I want the audience to also understand the craziness that's going on. So you have these electrodes that are implanted in this mouse's brain. They're sitting outside of the neurons, so like they're picking up a whole bunch of neuron activity that's going on around them. Some of it is like a bunch of like, you know, population noise. And some of it is like you might be sitting, an electrode bit might be sitting right next to a neuron and picking up like its actual changes in voltage, its actual action potentials that it's firing when it's communicating with all of the other neurons it's connected to. It is a massive task to go through and determine what is one single neuron at firing and what is a bunch of, like, you know, farther out neurons that's like background activity you're just kind of picking up. Both are useful with this massive amount of data because you are collecting this from several different brain areas and hundreds of different neurons at thousands of times per second. Is your software doing that, like figuring out what is one neuron versus many neurons, or is this like something that people are still having to do?
So there's that is certainly a problem. There's two approaches that we're using to overcome that. And in this case, we is a couple hundred labs. So first, the NeuroPixels, and this has been a movement across several different types of electrodes. They have many recording sites that are fairly close to each other. And so if you think of these as microphones trying to pick up the signals and the ambient noise, if you have more of those spread out over an area, you can better triangulate and figure out, to use that analogy of microphones, there's me and someone who has a voice similar to mine. If you have more microphones and, you know, that person's 10 feet away from me and there's a layout of these microphones across space, it makes it easier to pull this out. So the hardware is actively trying to help with some of these issues. On the other side, the software is using new methods, including machine learning methods, to learn these waveforms and to track them better. Because sometimes, to even make matters worse, the neurons move around a little bit over time or become more or less active. And so we're using a platform called Kilosort 3, which is also open source, heck yes, developed by Marius Pachitaru and several others, that is sort of leading the way with other platforms in trying to solve this very difficult problem. The one ray of sunshine, although I think all these algorithms do a pretty good job, is that there have been several studies now that have said, you know, it's good to have all this information and a better idea of what neuron is saying what, but it also kind of doesn't matter. If we take multi-unit activity, for most things, you get the same story. I do want an accurate report of single unit activity, but for much of what we're asking, the experts say, we're probably okay with whatever.
What other questions do you have about this paper?
Well, I'm just very interested in the intense research of like seeing how, you know, because I feel like especially with mice, a lot of people like will look down on that. You know what I mean? We don't really think, like you were saying before, like they're a lot smarter than we give them credit for. Like here in New York, there's more like there's so many rats here. They hired a rat czar. Like this is not a joke, to eradicate the rat. Like this has always been a problem. There's more rats than people. Anyways, like I'm always just very interested in how we're viewing that as these like tiny little animals are able to just tell us so much about ourselves in a way, and how we as humans, you know, even though like our brains are bigger and we're bigger and like stuff like that, I'm just very interested in like, what were your like revelations during these experiments of like, wow, like I didn't even know they could do that.
So something that's kind of fun, and I haven't thought about it that way quite like that, is even within science, there is a human-centric point of view stemming from the point of, well, we're humans. We want to understand the human brain and human behavior. And so if you study non-human primates, then you know, there's some questions you can ask with them that you can't in humans, but you know, you're almost at the gold standard, but that automatically makes the work there more valuable than in a rat, in a mouse, in a zebrafish, in a fly. And when I was in grad school not too long ago, that was, yeah, the monkey people just didn't read papers from mouse labs. I get the sense that that is changing. Maybe it's somewhat to do with me being in a leading a mouse lab, and so I try and feel better about myself. But because some of the tools, and you know, we have things like optogenetics where we can turn neurons on and off with light, and with one electrode that might span a whole brain area in a monkey, that same electrode in the mouse, like I said, gets me five areas. I think the playing field is getting leveled more, and in the future, that may change. And to come back to, you know, things like neuropsychiatric disorders, it's not worth too much. And we study OCD in our lab, but it's studying that in a viable, or studying disorders like that in viable human or non-human primate work, say through imaging with the human work, is likely still more valuable. But if you don't, depending on the question, I think rodents have really come into their own, as well as, you know, like we said, the flies. I think the playing field is getting leveled out more in terms of that real bias towards we're human, we only care about humans. I'd be curious, Jamie, if your thoughts on that.
I had so many thoughts while you were saying that. The first one was, I'm going to be honest, I don't read fly research. I should, though, for the sole reason that fly geneticists come up with the most wild names for genes. It is honestly like mouse geneticists are like, this is the vesicular GABAergic transporter. And fly geneticists are like, this is a totally different gene, not related to that gene. But fly geneticists are like, this is the Sonic the Hedgehog gene.
Okay, I'm going to be honest. The first thing you said sounds like a weapon from like Star Trek.
Yes.
Or something like that. And I was like, yeah, let's use this for Triculator or whatever. Like,
if you are a neuroscientist, the first name is the most boring thing possible. But so I should read fly papers, and not just because they have fun names. But actually, so I did a year of research before joining the PhD program in Ilya Manasov's lab, who is a monkey person who works closely with your former mentor, Larry Snyder. And while I was in Ilya's lab, he kind of had like the monkey work covered. He was like, there's not really a whole lot of like projects that I can put you on for the monkey work, but like I kind of wanted to, he like kind of wanted to get into studying the same thing, the same kinds of like decision making things in mice, because with mice you have all these like genetic mouse lines and you can like do all sorts of weird manipulations in mice that you can't do in monkeys. You can't CRISPR a monkey as of right now. So he was like, we're going to get into mice. So I do see that like field blurring a little bit, at least in my own experience, that this like very, you know, non-human primate lab researcher was like, we're going to get into mice, and seeing that as an asset to understanding the things that he was studying, because you can have a larger number of mice than you can monkeys. Most primate labs have like three or four monkeys maybe going at a time, like at most. There's not a lot of primates because they're expensive to take care of, they're large, and you want to use them for years and years and years and years and years. Mice, they're small, you can house a bunch of them in one cage. You can have one get pregnant and then it'll have a whole litter of mice like a month-ish later. And like people have made all these genetically modified mouse lines that you can use. There's my cat.
Oh my God. She's just over it. And I love it. She's just like existing. I love a dense cat.
I love a dense cat.
I love it. Well, this just overall was like a very interesting paper. I feel it was cool to like read about how just like there's the process of decision making and how many steps there are involved in it, and how like, you know what I mean? You never really like think about that or like But to have it just like dissected in that way, that was just really interesting to read.
With this one in particular, there were some challenges because we had to substantiate it in terms of the algorithm and the robustness of all that. But ultimately, the people we want to have reading it, many of them, most of them probably, have very little mathematical background, which is one of the reasons why we spend so much time on the user interface and these things. But to write a paper for both audiences was that there was plenty that Alex and I learned in the process. It's like, oh, but if we don't do that, then all this nuanced feature will be lost and no one will know about it. I'm like, only the people who already know what that is will care. And there were plenty of things that he taught me as well. But that was a fun challenge there, to in terms of writing it, as well as just generally in terms of the, you know, when I give talks about the paper, finding where that line is. Because even tonight, we've talked about, you know, the differences between unsupervised and supervised learning and plenty of other rabbit holes we could have gone down there. But at the end of the day, what I think is useful to most of the people, at least the people that I want to talk to, are the questions that it can answer and how to make it a better tool, not necessarily the inner workings of it. Though without that, you don't have a good tool. So yeah, it's a weird dichotomy. Hopefully it was accessible for someone who's not steeped in that side of things. And
well, you know, I don't really read a lot of like research papers and stuff like that, but this was just like interesting to me. I think just because like I do have ADHD and like I'm around like that community a lot. And like, I do have trouble with like decision-making sometimes, especially like really important ones. I think it was interesting to like see such like a normal human behavior. Cause like we make decisions every single day. Like there's not a day in our lives where we don't do that. So to see it just like, again, like broken down like that was very interesting and very eye-opening. I was like, oh, wow, like this is kind of how, and especially to see like everyone's scientific method and how like really like, you know, I would do like experiments or like research things in like high school or whatever for like a chem lab or something. But to see it like this and to see really how like scientists out there are really researching important things that will hopefully be used later on to help people with something like Parkinson's or dementia or like things like that, I think is really cool.
Building a tool for yourself is worthwhile to you. Building a tool for a community is more work, but exponentially more rewards, hopefully.
And important, especially right now. There's so much like important work going on, you know.
To their credit, NIH is slowly but surely, at least in some avenues, coming around on that. Thankfully, I think things are changing from a funding level as well as from a publication level, which I think are the two pillars that really decide what does get done. Because something can be important to you, but if I can't fund somebody to maintain B-side, it stays where it is. Yeah, it's good. I think the future is bright for this field of science and open science in general.
Well, no, I think like, again, like kind of what you were saying, it's good that there's this kind of science out there, because especially right now, everyone's so focused on like AI and OpenAI and all this stuff that like we can't control and things like that. So it's really good to see like people like the ins and outs of doing like experiments like this that are really important. And like, I'm happy like you think the future looks bright, because I think that's like the attitude we all need right now.
I actually have a question for you, Sarah, actually for both of you, but particularly a bit more naive point of view. If you could find out anything about the brain, whether or not it's actually findoutable currently or not, what sorts of things would you ask? Because that's actually to, you know, the data that the papers that we're working on now of record all the neurons and all the behavior. We have some hypotheses, but a lot of it is let's fuck around and find out, which is of mixed value. But part of it is like, just if we have lots and lots of data, and this is really part of the whole premise of machine learning. If you have lots and lots and lots of data, say Facebook or Google, you find things out. And that's not the approach. We do have some hypotheses. From a naive point of view, yeah, if you could record from every neuron in a human brain and a rat brain and a fly brain, doing what, how, whatever, what sort of things would you want to find the answer to?
Ooh, I know what I would want. I would want to know about like smell and why it triggers memories. Because they say that's like the most significant form, you know, and I like, if especially with like a cologne or something like that, or like a specific like detergent that you would use like growing up, like why that triggers a memory. Because like that's something you can Google and people have all these theories, but I would want to know that.
A lot of that's figured out, so that's good.
Oh, great. Yeah, I did the easy stuff. What would you
want? Yeah, Jamie, what do you want?
I don't know. See, the thing is, I'm like, take a step back, take a couple more steps back. Because that, like, in the middle of my PhD, I'm so down the rabbit hole of like, you know, this one brain area and how does it impact like pain? And so I'm like, okay, no. Back up. Over here. Okay, good. We're over here. Ooh, I don't know. Understanding like really big picture. Because this is something that like is so hard to get at with the kind of like one brain region science. But like, how do we have all this like metacognition about ourselves? And how do we like think about ourselves perceiving the world? Basically, like,
you want to find the soul. Is that?
Yeah. But in the brain.
Okay, great.
Which is like not one brain area. You like need to be able to like integrate everything that's going on across like the entirety of not just your brain, but also your peripheral nervous system, because like how you interact with the world is also like a factor in how you like are thinking about the world, and it all feeds back on each other. It's like this huge big picture thing that like right now we can kind of like the issue is kind of like right now you can go small. So you can record single neurons and you can see like really intricate details of how this one neuron is firing. And if you have like a mouse that's doing a behavior, you can, like in the paper, we can see like how are these individual neurons firing with relation to how the mouse is doing behavior. And so like then you can see like there is you can classify them into types of neurons and be like this type of neuron is like becomes active right before the mouse starts walking. So it probably has something to do with the mouse like deciding to go walk somewhere. But that doesn't really tell you like a lot else about like what did the mouse see over there that it wants to go walk to, and like how does the mouse feel about the thing that it's walking to go do, and like all this other stuff, right? So you can go small or you can go big. You can use like the fMRI we were talking about earlier in humans to see brain activity in very broad regions of the brain. It can't get anywhere near a single cell level. It's looking at like this chunk of the brain right here, like that's underneath here. What is it doing? So, and like it's getting better all the time and we're getting finer and finer resolution all the time. But it's still like such a broad scale when compared to the scale of single neurons. And so you can see broadly, these regions are connected. They activate together. They, like, when you're doing this thing, like, they're both lighting up. Or these two regions have nothing to do with one another. You can see that. But you can't really see intricate dynamics of, like, how is that circuit actually working? And that is where I feel like a lot of the cutting edge of neuroscience is actually happening, is like integrating the big perspective and the small perspective. And I think that's kind of what you need to understand, like these big picture questions about the brain and how we all see and understand the world.
Yeah, it's not easy at any level.
Because you can go even smaller than the level of a single neuron and you can be recording from one channel and be like, what does this one like pore in the membrane of a neuron do? And that's super important, but it's also like, yeah, the most zoomed in and like specific.
And to imagine there's millions of these pores of all different sorts and thousands of different inputs, and we don't even know how a neuron exactly integrates these hyperpolarizations and depolarizations. We have a good idea, but there's some things that still boggle the mind in terms of all that. Yeah, it's the more we know, the more we don't know.
This is something people are like, we're just gonna like upload our brains into the computer. You can't do that. And part of the reason you can't do that is that like neurons are not like one input, one output. It's you're getting input from tens of thousands of other cells, like, or even more. I don't actually know what the order of magnitude is. Like contacting the neuron everywhere along its like little processes and like cell body and everything. And then that neuron takes all that information, and some of those cells are saying like, you should fire more, send more information. Some of those are saying you should fire less, you should send less information. Some of those are being like, well, we're just gonna like turn up or down the gain on how much you're firing, like making all these different kinds of modifications to this cell. And that cell's taking all of it in and going like, here's what I'm gonna send out to all of the like thousands of other cells that I'm contacting. And so like this scale of complexity, even when you're thinking about the information that's coming into one neuron, is kind of insane. And you multiply that a million fold or more, and there's your brain.
I tell my lab that everyone needs a black box, and it's up to you just to decide what level you're comfortable with, because you can't, getting all of it is typically not tenable.
Before we go, I would love to know, we'll start with Eric and then Sarah, if you have anything to promote that people should, where can people find you? What should they be looking for?
So for myself, there's B-Side, which is out. And if you go to GitHub or bside.org, bside.org, there's a tutorial there. And as long as you know how to install it on your computer, and even if you don't, we give you the directions. You can do it, and it'll work on a laptop. You don't need a fancy GPU. Although if you have one, it'll help. A-Side, also Google it, GitHub or BioArchive, it's there. And the tool is only as good as how well it's used. So if you have a question, please reach out to me. Last name is Yttri, Carnegie Mellon. Yeah, if anyone is interested in what we do or the lab, we'll be, Alex will be talking about some of these data in a talk on Saturday at SFN coming up in November. And we've got two other posters, one also Saturday afternoon, and the other is Monday afternoon. Always excited about talking to new smart people, or if they want to find room in a lab, we always have room for new smart people. Just got an exciting postdoc that's going to help us out with this.
That is awesome. I will definitely check out those talks and posters at SFN. And if you're at SFN, we should meet up.
Absolutely. I'll be there.
And then Sarah, what do you have got? What do you have to promote?
Well, I have my own podcast called The Queerients, and I talk to people in the LGBTQIA+ community about their stories, what they have going on. And I post like two episodes a month, so you can look that up on the Queerience podcast on like Instagram or Twitter.
Yep. And that'll also be linked in the description for this podcast. Thank you. Thank you both so, so much. This has been an amazing conversation.
Yeah, it's been a ton of fun.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having us. Yeah, this was so cool and interesting.
Yeah, so we have been talking about, just as a reminder, we've been talking about the paper, I now know how to pronounce it, B-Side, an open source unsupervised algorithm for identification and fast prediction of behaviors by Alex Su and Eric Yttri. And our guests have been Dr. Eric Yttri and Sarah Brown. Our music is by Sam Brunwasser. You can find more of his work at soundcloud.com/visualsnowbeats. As always, you can download the paper and read the transcriptions at inplainenglishpod.org. And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Plain English Sci. That's PlainEnglishSci. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of In Plain English.